This morning we discussed texts 37 and 38 from Tattvasandarbha. These are two texts that just continue Jiva Goswami's refutation of Mayavad philosophy on the basis of Vyasadeva's realization under the instruction of Narada Muni, his spiritual master. Vyasadeva sat in trance of meditation. His heart became filled with certain realizations. He saw the personality of Godhead, Krishna, in his original feature, which means if you see Krishna in his original feature, you see his whole abode, you see everything. He saw the living entity under the influence, bewildered influence of Maya. Maya not under influencing the Supreme Lord Krishna, but at a distance, under his control. He saw time. He saw all these things. And what he saw is very different than what Shankaracharya says the Vedas say. So we've been hearing this. We reviewed something that was from yesterday evening, the three different procedures by which, according to Shankara's followers, Brahman becomes covered or under the influence of upadis or limiting designations. Parichet, Pratibimba, those were the two. And that's what was reviewed this morning. Parichet is this example of using Gopi Pranadanda's language, delimiting. I don't know why he put delimiting instead of limiting, but it's because delimiting sounds like the opposite of limiting. Anyway, delimiting Brahman. And we heard this is if the upadis are real. Why it's unreasonable to say that Brahman becomes limited or delimited by upadis. One of them is, just review, Brahman can't be divided. It's one, it's indivisible, can't be divided. So you can't limit that which can't be limited or divided. Then another, Jiva Goswami says, where is this upadi or the pot that covers the sky? Where did the pot come from? Where does this upadi come from if there's only one thing? Then you have two things. Another is, by the statements of the Vedas and the statements of Shankara, Brahman is pure knowledge, so how does pure knowledge become covered by ignorance? It's like saying the sun becomes covered by a cloud. You can't cover the sun with a cloud. You can't cover pure knowledge with ignorance. And then a fourth was that which has no change, if it's uncovered and then becomes covered and then becomes uncovered, then there's changes in Brahman, so how can you have that? Because it's not what Brahman is. It's quite unreasonable proposal of how Brahman becomes covered by upadis. And then the theory of reflection is similarly unsubstantial. Basically, that which is invisible, you can't reflect it. You may reflect something that's within the sky, and that's in the reflection, but the sky, or Brahman, is invisible, so how can you reflect it? And then, that was 37. 38 was, once again, if the upadis are real, because next he's going to deal with what if they're not real. They're just imagined. They're hallucinations. It's not real. But if the upadis are real, then two main things. You can't dispel that which is real just by adjusting your thinking. Like the example of the poor man in prison thinking, I'm a king. He doesn't get out of prison and doesn't stop being poor just by thinking, I'm the king. And the second was, not all Mayavadis say the same thing, but some Mayavadis say, well, this non-real upadi can be dismissed by knowledge, and that the person who possesses the knowledge is Ishvara. So Jiva Goswami says, by this, inadvertently, they're saying there's two entities. There's one that's covered, the other that's not covered. And then the other is by descending mercy, the one that's covered can become uncovered. Which is what we say. Two other points, just review from this morning. We saw a slide that had two, and there's actually, I think there's four or five principal utterances from the Vedas, Maha Vakya. Vaishnavas use this term Maha Vakya also. There's a principal utterance or Maha Vakya from Rupa Goswami's Nectar of Devotion, Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. Is the definition of bhakti, because Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu is about bhakti. So there's a verse that gives the definition of bhakti, and that's the principal utterance or the Mahavakya of Nectar Devotion. Anya Vilashita Shunyam Jnana Karmadya Navratam Anukulyena Krishna Anushilanam Bhakti Uttama. That's the verse. And that one verse, Jiva Goswami discusses this, by the way, in the beginning parts of Tattva Sandarbha. A principal utterance is that which governs all other statements. Anything that follows, it has to be understood in terms of that one. If it looks like, we're going to touch on it now in this session, if it looks like it's something different, then you have to interpret, because there's a Sanskrit rule. Sanskrit rule is you must take the direct meaning, unless it just doesn't make sense. And then only can you take an indirect meaning. So it's a rule of Sanskrit. Similarly, this Mahavakya, it governs every other statement. If it seems that some other statement is contrary to the Mahavakya, it has to be interpreted in such a way that it lines up with the Mahavakya. Or is in harmony with that message. It's the same message. You can't have a contradictory message different than the Mahavakya. So, Srimad Bhagavatam similarly has a Mahavakya. Jiva Goswami reveals what that is. And it's a verse that we've all heard so many times. Ete Changsakala Pungsa Krishnastu Bhagavan Swayam. He says it in Tattva Sandarbha. He says it again in Krishna Sandarbha. Krishna is the original source of everything. All his expansions, all his potencies, the material creation, the spiritual realm, everything is from that one source, Krishna, Swayam Bhagavan Krishna. So all of the other 17,999 verses of Srimad Bhagavatam must be understood in relation to that one. Similarly, Shankara says, there are certain Mahavakyas, plural, and Tattvamasi is one, and Aham Brahmasmi is the other. And Jiva Goswami was helping us understand the proper way of understanding that utterance from Chandogya Upanishad. Tattvamasi. tat is the pronoun indicating the supreme, and tum is you. You are that. And it's a qualitative oneness, not an absolute oneness, because there's difference. Qualitatively, there's oneness, and there's also difference. Quantitative difference. The living entity, according to Vyasa's realization, is under the influence of Maya, and the supreme Paramapurusha, or Purna Purusha, is not. He is the shelter. He controls Maya. The living entity is controlled by Maya. So there's difference and sameness at the same time. He gave this nice example of gold bangles and the gold mine from which the bangles come. There's this Sanskrit term, adikarana. Karana means causation. Adi means original. Adikarana means something that's foundational. So there's a foundational sameness of the gold bangle with the gold mine. There's a foundational sameness of the living entity with the supreme. That's the sameness indicated in Tattvamasi. It doesn't express what the difference is, it just says the sameness. So there is a sameness. And there's a difference. So overemphasizing the sameness with neglect of the difference is incomplete. So that's a little review of what we covered this morning. And just before this, Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtana, was the slide that says what some Mayavadis say: by descending mercy, the jnana feature of Ishwara or Krishna, when bestowed upon the living entity, frees the living entity from bondage, which is what Vaishnavas say. So we need that mercy, and thus Param Vijayate Sri Krishna Sankirtanam. There's another nice picture of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan. So now, depending upon how it goes, we'll cover little bit or more than a little bit. And we'll see how it goes. So what I had planned was we just cover two more verses. But I think we can cover more than two more verses. And if we do that, then we'll have more time to discuss the concluding portion of Tattva Sandarbha. So let's just see how it goes. So in 37 and 38, we heard about if the upadis are real. Now we're going to hear Jiva Goswami describe. Some Mayavadis say, Shankaracharya said different things, but one of them was the upadis aren't real. In fact, they're just hallucinations, imagination. So now, if that's the case, if the upadis are not real products of illusion, then however you work it, division or some other process of how it happens that Brahman becomes influenced by that which doesn't exist, then how can an unreal illusion cover that which is real? It doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense. And similarly, using analogies that may fit worldly circumstance doesn't fit something that's unreal. If it's just an unreal dream, you can't impose an unreal dream on something that's real and say this equals that, or this is similar to that. It doesn't work. Their system of metaphor doesn't work. It is impossible to establish a relationship between something that exists and something that doesn't exist. It's kind of obvious. But these big intellectuals do it anyways. Something that doesn't exist is compared to something that exists. It's a no-no as far as logic is concerned. It's illogical. Therefore, Jiva Goswami concludes, whatever is proposed is just they're creating, spinning an illusion. Now, here's this text that I've been promising you all along. Here's the dates of Buddha's life. It's not clearly understood. There are different opinions and versions. But between 6,000 BC and 4,000 BC, or 6th century, somewhere in there. And as we discussed in the morning, he rejected them. It's Kali Yuga, people abusing the Vedas, and in the name of the Vedas, doing abusive things, like slaughter of animals. So he took the position, I reject the Vedas, and instead follow me. Now I say, don't kill animals. Be nonviolent. Which is what the Vedas say. And then later accept the Vedas. But there's this interesting statement found in Padma Purana. Someone was asking, what does this term Mayavada means? Well, here it is in Padma Purana. It's not like somebody pulled it out of the air. Mayavadam asat chastram. Chastram, shastra. It's against. And pra chanam bodham. Chanam means covered. Pra chanam bodham is that it's covered Buddhism. Mayavad teaching is covered Buddhism. Now this is from Padma Purana. Not, some Vaishnava scholar got creative. And that is to say, just like before Buddha appeared in the Bhagavatam, it describes Buddha would appear. Future tense. And even down to where he would appear, what his mother's name would be, and what he would teach, and why he appeared, before he appeared. So this is similar. This is before Shankaracharya appeared. In Padma Purana, it's being stated he's going to appear in Kali Yuga. Kalau. He's going to appear in a Brahmana family. Lord Shiva saying to Parvati, I will appear in Kali Yuga in a Brahmana family and teach covered Buddhism. And it's going to be known as Mayavada. Very interesting, huh? Translation. Mayavada is a false doctrine. In fact, it is simply covered Buddhism. In Kali Yuga, my dear goddess, I take birth as a Brahmana to propagate this philosophy. Pretty direct. And then there's other references. One of those other references is from Shiva. Oh, it's being cut off at the bottom, but the Shiva Purana, the Supreme Lord instructed Lord Shiva to appear. Okay, we're having a little noise session in the background here. The personality of Godhead told Lord Shiva, we discussed it this morning, why would he do that? Yuga. Okay, take a deep breath because we're going to get even a little more specific and detailed. Are you ready? You're used to it by now. Like, what's What's next, Maharaj? It's like, I'll summarize it to keep it simple. Here's some nice graphics. What you see up in orange of Shankara's teachings, and it's taken from the Vedas, there's three levels of reality. There's the Brahman level of reality, there's the worldly level of reality, and then there's simply hallucination. We'll do it again. Brahman level of reality. That's the only reality. Then there's this upadhi's reality. And that has its Sanskrit term. And then there's just hallucination and dreams and madness and something that doesn't even exist at all. Not even in an upadhi form, it's just an illusion within the illusion. Their idea, Jiva Goswami is going to say, is these are then imposed upon the second to get what appears to be, and then there's reality. You with me? Should I say it again? Say it again. According to Shankara's teachings, there's three levels of reality, and there's only one of them is really reality, and that's Brahman, undifferentiated Brahman. Then there's this appearance of reality where upadhis, remember Brahman is vidya. No, it's jnana. Then there's illusion that's ajnana, that's the third category. Just doesn't even exist. And then this thing that doesn't exist covers Brahman, and that becomes the second reality, that which appears to be. You know, we're in South Plainfield, New Jersey. It appears to be. But actually all it is Brahman. And then the thing that covers Brahman, that's the thing that doesn't even exist. Vidya covered by avidya. Excuse me. Jnanam covered by ajnana. Reality covered by illusion. And then there's divisions of how that illusion divides itself up into five things, and then you get what appears to be the second level of reality. You with me? Okay, good. So now there's Sanskrit terms for all of this, and say, what are those three levels of reality in Sanskrit? But they're terms that come directly from the Vedas. And it, by word jugglery, you get, you know, the world that you see can be dispelled and you can start to see reality instead of the world that you see by knowledge. Study Vedanta Sutra and you'll... Okay, so here we go. How can analogies concerning the qualities of concrete things be used to explain the effect of nothing? That's this third reality that doesn't even exist. It's just hallucination. Remember those three? Parichet, Pratibimba, and what was the third one? Vist. So this is, if upadhis don't exist, Vivarta. So that third category of reality, it doesn't even exist. So how can something that doesn't even exist cover something that exists? That's what he's saying. The effect of nothing on Brahman. I'm supposed to read something for you. This is paragraph 3 of the commentary. Some of you have books. So if you want, you can read along from your book. And if you want to read along, it's at the bottom of page 162. Final section. Here's these three. So The language is the Tatmartika. That's Brahman. The Mayavadis distinguish three basic levels of reality. The real reality of impersonal Brahman is called Paramartika. On this level, Brahman is perfect and changeless, but has no qualities, no variety, no activities. In short, the Mayavadis say, in effect, that Brahman is nothing. Sounds like voidism, doesn't it? Well, it's covered voidism, covered Buddhism. Brahman, in effect, is nothing. No this, no this, neti, neti, neti. No color, no form, no qualities, no name, no nothing, no nothing, nothing. What is it? It's nothing. That's what it is. In effect. Although they don't say so directly. It's what we see. We don't see Brahman. We see stuff. South Plainfield, New Jersey. It's called Vyavaharika. Vyavaharika. Here's the categories of Vyavaharika. God, Jivas, physical universe belong to the Vyavaharika reality, the day-to-day working existence of illusion. Because Brahman is reality, and then there's the appearance of reality that's just covered by illusion. Vyavaharika. The Vyavaharika upadis imposed on Brahman have no absolute value and can fulfill their ultimate purpose only by annihilating themselves. Yay! Nihilism. Sound familiar? Born of frustration, exactly as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Finally, the third reality. Dreams, hallucinations, misperceptions pertain to the pratibhashika reality, the reality that exists only for a short time in one's mind. In contrast with the public and longer-lasting reality of Vyavaharika world, you know, South Plainfield, New Jersey. Pratibhashika experience, being illusion within illusion, is false in the strongest sense. Okay, so back to what we have on the screen up here. In our common experience, pots, this thing over here, delimiting part of the atmosphere. That happens. Pots enclose part of the sky. It happens. Vyavaharika, reality. Or pots filled with water, reflecting the sun. There's that one over on the right side. So it happens. There's a picture of it. It happens. These are instances of interactions of matter in accordance with the Vyavaharika laws of nature. It's directly Vedic. There are such laws of nature. And it's part of everyday routine conditional existence. These physical laws, though helping scientists make sense of what occurs on the Vyavaharika level of existence, can hardly explain how Brahman could degrade from its Paramartika perfection, or the real reality of impersonal Brahman. So it's taken something from the illusory strata to the real strata and saying the real strata becomes covered like a pot encloses the parts of the sky or the sun or a tree, in this case, being reflected on the surface of water. It's improper to make that kind of inference or comparison. Now, Jiva Goswami is very kind and very precise. He's going to explain when these references are made in the Vedas. Here is how we should understand them. While rejecting this other understanding, here is how we should understand them. He's not trashing it altogether. Here's the proper way to understand. So, there's a pot. And inside the pot, there's some sky. And outside the pot, there's some sky. There are such examples. And in this case, how is it properly understood? Well, the jiva, that's the soul that's embodied with the gross and subtle body, the body, in this case, gross and subtle, is the pot. The body, gross and subtle, is the pot. And in that case, part of the sky is within the pot, in the same sense that the living entity is a tiny fragmental part of the Supreme that has part of his eternality, bliss, and knowledge. That's the proper understanding of this metaphor, the pratibimba metaphor. Excuse me, parichayed metaphor. It's correct. This is the correct way of understanding. Understanding is, within this body, there's a soul, and the covering of the soul is like the pot, indicating that within the body, there's a tiny, tiny fragmental part of the Supreme, qualitatively one with the Supreme. Eternally so, even when the pot is broken, eternally, qualitatively one with, quantitatively different, we don't become God. Or when you become liberated. But it's describing a present state of existence. Or, the correct understanding of this next one, parichayed, is the jiva is like a water film in the sense that in that reflection, there is resemblance to the sun. That's the Vedic use of this term. While the jiva's form and personality reflect those of God, it doesn't mean the living entity is God, or there's no such thing as a living entity and no such thing as God. Reflection of that which exists within God as the reflection of light in water gives some indication of the light of the sun. Now, he starts getting a little feisty and calls all of this business incoherent presumptions. So there is, he concedes, Jiva Goswami concedes, there's a complicated relationship between God and Maya. I mean, there's fundamental principles, but when the whole machine starts to move, it gets pretty complicated. So here's the proper way to understand this complication or the involvement with Maya and God. Now here's the incoherent rambling of Shankara's teaching. Brahman, given. Brahman is perfect, perfectly pure because it's unalloyed spirit and can in no way be affected by avidya because it's jnana. It's knowledge as opposed to illusion. But in comes avidya, affecting that which isn't affected. And avidya affects Brahman. Anyhow. And this combination is impure, and that creates a jiva. Next. to assist the non-existent jiva in pursuit of his non-existent happiness, personality of Godhead comes into being to assist the jiva to try to find his non-existent happiness. And by the way, the personality of Godhead is also non-existent. It's just an upadhi covering Brahman. But it has the capacity to give knowledge to relieve the living entity, the non-existent living entity of his non-existent suffering in pursuit of non-existent happiness. And if it doesn't happen that he gets knowledge, then lifetime after lifetime, the non-existent jiva is created again and again for non-existence in pursuit of non-existence happiness. Jiva Goswami says, such a situation is full of contradictions. It involves the following incoherent presumptions: that within the pure spiritual entity, Brahman, avidya enters, and that God is an upadhi produced by that avidya, and within God there is vidya, the opposite of avidya, and that although full of vidya, God is still illusory. You want to buy one of those? We have lots of them for sale. It's a special, it's Black Friday. Take a half a dozen, you get a wholesale price. Now, next is a nice chart. I'm going to flip back and forth between this one and the next one. This is from Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his list of our disciplic succession, of course, starting from Krishna and Brahma, Narada and Vyas. Then comes Madhvacharya. Now, Madhvacharya's duration, the period of his life, obviously it comes before Lord Chaitanya, but it comes after Shankaracharya. And he was like really firm in refuting Shankar's, all this gobbledygook that we've been hearing. And he did so by his folding up two fingers like this, saying, duality, there's a difference between the living entity and God. There's a difference between living entities and living entities. There's a difference between living entities and matter. There's a difference between one type of matter and another type of matter, etc. So he called it Panchabheda. Forget this. Now, there is oneness, but to defeat the there is only oneness, he made emphasis on the other side of the pan scale. There's two. In bold letters are Jayatirtha and Vyasatirtha, all came before Madhavendrapuri. These two, Jayatirtha and Vyasatirtha, are very, very strong authors, very respected in Madhvacharya's line. Of course, always deferring to the founder, Madhvacharya, but they taught very specific things. And Vyasatirtha is particularly known for his refutation of this Pratibimba and Parichet exhaustively, by use of nyaya, which means logic. It's of course scriptural reference, but stitching together the scriptural references in a very logical way, just as Jiva Goswami is doing for us. So, his writing is called, I don't think he called it, they called it nyayamrita, the nectar of logic. So he refuted these two, Pratibimba and Parichet, strongly. So now we'll go to the next slide. And here's Madhusudana Vachaspati, Madhusudana Saraswati. Now he's in the line, this is Shankaracharya when he lived. And so after Vyasatirtha, there's when Vyasatirtha lived, after him came this fellow, Madhusudana Saraswati. And Because Vyasatirtha's refutation was so strong, he came up with another idea, another Mayavad idea. And his other Mayavad idea, Jiva Goswami is going to tear that apart next slide. But it's known as Eka Jiva Vad. If you want to chuckle, here's what it says. Once upon a time, there was one jiva, Brahman known as jiva, but like, you know, a jiva. And this one jiva creates a whole world that's his illusion, including the illusion that other jivas exist. There's no other jivas that exist except this one jiva, but he created an illusion that says other jivas exist. And because of this, Eka Jiva Vad, he glanced. Mahavishnu, glance, drishti. And then things came into being, srishti. So it's sometimes called drishti shishti vada. No, it's taken from the Purusha Sukta prayers of Rig Veda that describe how creation takes place. And if you're a follower of the Vedas, you got to follow the Vedas. So he just created a, you know, an interesting interpretation of once upon a time. It doesn't say Mahavishnu because that means a person. So it's just Eka Jiva. Without giving him a name or a form or quality, it's just Eka Jiva. And he creates this illusion. Jiva Goswami comments, although it was significantly prior, Prakashananda Saraswati, this fellow that Lord Chaitanya interacted with, had the same idea, just didn't write it down as thoroughly and comprehensively. This Madhusudana Saraswati spent his whole lifetime composing intricate word jugglery. This means that. For his whole lifetime to create this ideology of Eka Jiva Vada. You have to give it to them. They really try hard. That's like Jarasandha, really determined. So Jiva Goswami takes a shot at the inconsistencies in this incoherent Eka Jiva theory. And it goes as follows. Somehow, that's inexplicably, the pure self, this Eka Jiva, is supposed to have contracted, like it, you contract, just Prabhupada's language, you contract a disease. Your resistance is low when you come in contact with the disease and you contract the disease. So, this Eka Jiva contracted avidya. He's now infected with the disease of avidya, which then in turn creates, he creates himself, now he's a limited jiva. And this one jiva imagines a world of illusion, which he becomes the foundation of, or the god of, some imaginary world. It's better than Harry Potter, isn't it? The imagined God then uses material nature to entrap the pure self in illusion, creating again and again so many jivas in this imagined illusion of his. Valadeva Vidyabhusan says, these are simply the incoherent ramblings of fools. Sensible people would never speak like this. But he spent his whole lifetime creating this. And, you know, obviously he believed it. And obviously he got some other people to believe it. And concluding, Here's quotes from Chaitanya Charitamrita where Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said two things. This doctrine of Mayavad, they're offenders to Krishna. And here's another verse from Madhya chapter 6. Vyasadeva presented Vedanta philosophy for the deliverance of conditioned souls. But if one hears the Mayavad commentary of Shankaracharya, everything is spoiled. Now we're almost done with this section, because if you remember, this is text 40, and it goes through 43, 41, 42, 43. So what I had planned on the schedule that was in the handout sheet is that tonight we would cover 41, 42, and 43. Let's see if there's some discussion, or if you like, I can just cover the next section, 41, 42, and 43. How are we doing? Discussion now and then continue, or just continue and then discussion? How are we doing? Keep going? Keep going. Okay. It's not so complicated. Not so complicated. Now, because this was planned for this evening, there's this opportunity for review. I don't think I need to review what we just now spoke. And again, here's Krishna Das Kaviraj warning us, we want our minds to become attached to Krishna, so don't avoid things that seem complicated like this. It'll help make your mind strong, and your mind is strong. You can chant your japa better, and you can become attached to Krishna better. So now the concluding part is actually easier. There's Vyas in his trance of meditation as instructed by Narada Muni. And he had a certain vision, or his heart became filled with some realization of this personality of Godhead. He saw the personality of Godhead in full. So Jiva Goswami reasons, if Shankaracharya is right, then that's what his vision would have been. It would have been that somehow Brahman got covered by upadis. And because of being covered by upadis, then Brahman started to get a toothache or feel miserable. But then there was a good solution. The miserable living entities saw really it's all one, and they just merged and became one, and then they became happy again. That's what it would have said. That's what he's saying it would have said. But that's not what Vyas saw, nor, very important, Shukadeva was already there at Brahman realization. Right? I mean, what Shankara is after is where Shukadeva already was. And Shukadeva left it behind for Krishna's wonderful qualities, which aren't illusion. He's not interested in illusion. Right? He's already beyond that, and Krishna promised him, you take birth from the womb of your mother, and you're not going to be influenced by illusion. He's not going to be attracted to illusion. So the heart of Shukadeva and the heart of Vyasadeva refute Shankara's teachings. Very practical. Rather, this Bhagavatam, which is based upon Vyasa's realization, is the mature fruit of he who compiled all the Vedas, including those portions that Shankara likes especially, Tattvamasi and Aham Brahmasmi. The one that understands the big picture is Vyas, and the Bhagavatam is the mature fruit of Vyas's realization. And nowhere in these verses, Vyas's realization verses, does one find some idea of ultimate oneness. It's not there. In fact, as this other image shows, Shukadev was already there at this ultimate impersonal liberation, had the Bhagavatam taught impersonalism, why would he undergo the trouble to study it? Because he was already there. So it's something other than what Shankara is teaching. The heart of Shukadeva is something other. And why would the personal qualities of Krishna attract one who is not interested in anything material? If the qualities of Krishna are just Drupadi. See the importance of these realizations of Vyas, or the heart of Vyas and the heart of Shukadev, to get a proper understanding of what the message of the Vedas is, and the message of the Bhagavatam, which is the ripened fruit of the message of the Vedas. That was 41. Now we just have two more to go. 42. Jiva Goswami takes us down the path of, all right, in the Upanishads it does speak of this pratibimba and parichet. We already touched on it, the pot and the reflection. Remember that slide? Very important. This is this Mahavakya message. So, if it appears, if there's something in the Bhagavatam or something in the Vedas that appears to be different than Vyasa's realization, what are you supposed to do? You're supposed to interpret. Well, wait a minute. We just got on Shankaracharya's case for interpreting stuff. So now you're saying Jiva Goswami is telling us we have to interpret stuff? So we're doing the same thing that he did. It's a no-no. Twisting and distorting the Vedic message by interpretation. That's a no-no. We're not supposed to do that. However, that which governs everything else that's within the Bhagavatam and everything that's within the Vedas, because the Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the Vedas, it has to match Vyasa's realization. The mature stage of his realization after he did everything. And Shukadeva Goswami's realization after Brahman realization. And if there appears to be something that doesn't match that, then you have to line it up. You have to take a secondary meaning. Yes? That's what's being said. So there are some statements within the Vedas that are figurative expressions only, and we should understand them that way. Figurative expressions only. And that's using his methodology. He's making a statement. Now he's giving scripture to support his statement. But here's one scripture from Vedanta Sutra. Look at that. Where Vedanta Sutra says, Brahman is not like water in being involved in reflection. I guess Shankar just put that one under the rug or something. And then, in the same number three, Vedanta Sutra number three, remember this is process or abhideya. There's four parts of Vedanta Sutra, remember that? First two are sambandha, the second one, number three. So the third one is abhideya. So here's from that section. But Brahman does assume larger and smaller sizes. How are we to understand that? This much of the analogy applies fittingly for both Brahman and water. There's Vedanta Sutra. So now, how are we supposed to understand this? He's volunteering. He's not hoping you don't know those verses and just sneak it by you. He's presenting it to scholars that will know these things are there. And he's addressing it. Here's how you to understand it. He gives the example of a pond that covers part of the land. So on all the other sides of the pond, there's land, and underneath the water, there's land. So there's water that's covering land. That's an example of how the covering is how you're to understand things, that with this upadi, Brahman becomes divided by upadis. That's the Mayavadi's example. But we're to take this when it speaks of Brahman, not land and physical things, but Brahman is to say, as the earth appears parceled into various large and small areas, or as the sun appears in reflections of different sizes. We'll see some images that show this. They're really nice. The Supreme Lord similarly manifests unlimited expansions of himself, some with unlimited potency like his, others with limited potency. Yes? Krishna expands as Vishnu Tattva. Krishna expands as Jiva Tattva. Yes? Different potencies, but qualitatively like him, but quantitatively different. That's how we to understand it. Smaller and larger sizes. Now, Jiva Goswami says, why are we not making the same mistake or cheating as Shankaracharya, or twisting or distorting the message of the Vedas by making interpretations of certain things? And the answer he gives is no, because it has to conform with Vyasa's realization. So here's an example of an image. There's the moon and the setting sun. Now there's the reflection of the moon and the reflection of the setting sun in the water. So there are such things as reflections, for example. And the reflections give us an idea of the object. Or bodies of water, a little pond showing the reflection of the setting sun. Or a larger, where there's ripples of water and the setting sun. I hope this works. But sometimes, it doesn't show on the... Huh? What's it showing on my screen is those little sparkling things. That's the sun reflecting on little ripples of water. But it's dancing. Moving and moving and moving and moving. So there's a little motion picture of these little reflections of the sun moving. You can't see it. But I can see it. It's very nice. And then the next one, same thing. So as the water is moving in the video of what this image that you see, it's a moving picture. the reflections are dancing. They're smaller than the sun and they're moving. This is an example of a reflection of larger and smaller. Yes? So what is Jiva Goswami's message to us here? When you see within the Vedas something that seems to be in contradiction with Vyasa's realization, then and only then are you to take secondary meanings. And the secondary meanings is bigger and smaller aspects of Brahman are appropriate when it doesn't match Vyasadeva's realization, just like these little specks that's just a reflection of the sun. So how are we to understand that? It's not the fullness of the sun. Okay? Last text for this whole section. And this whole section, what the whole section is doing, starting with text 29, to text 43 is Shukadeva Goswami's heart and Vyasadeva's heart, and what's in their heart tells us what the message of the Bhagavatam is. And then taking those understandings and comparing them to what Shankara says and see do they match, because the heart of Shukadeva and the heart of Vyas match. They include the Sambandha Abhideya and Prayojana, that's what Lord Chaitanya taught to Shankaracharya, to Prakashananda Saraswati. It's his teachings also. Now this is 43. This is a concluding text from the whole section. And we've covered a lot. And so far we've only covered two of the six verses that share Vyasadeva's realization. Jiva Goswami is amazing, huh? Okay. Thus, scriptural statements that describe the oneness of the Jiva and the Supreme should be derived from Srila Vyasadeva's meditational experience. We can avoid contradictions by considering both difference and sameness. Remember that Krishna Das Kaviraj, don't worry about contradictions. We can resolve it by understanding their simultaneous oneness and difference. And that's how you resolve what's contradiction. Because it depends upon the feature that you're emphasizing. You can emphasize Tattvamasi, the oneness, and that's a right statement. And there's some differences. You can emphasize the differences. That's what Madhvacharya did. He emphasized differences. But there's also sameness and differences. So these contradictions are to be resolved that way. What's that? Compliments of Jiva Goswami to help us understand what the Bhagavatam teaches, what Vyasa's teaching, what Lord Chaitanya's teaching, by his very kind association. Although God and the Jivas are one in the sense of being equally spiritual entities, the Jivas are atomic particles, small, like small rays of the Jivas by virtue of the Supreme's own natural, inconceivable energy, which is fully competent to make any seemingly impossible arrangement. Later in this work, that's the Sandarbhas, Paramatma Sandarbha and Bhagavat Sandarbha. Later in this work, when we encounter such apparent contradictions, we reconcile them the same way. What's that same way? The Supreme Lord has inconceivable, unlimited and inconceivable potencies. That's how seeming contradictions are resolved. And he can exhibit them, and he can withdraw them. He can exhibit other ones and withdraw them. He can exhibit many of them, mix them, and then withdraw some of them. They move according to His will. And that's the nature of the Supreme. Jiva Goswami says, without accepting that, there's no question of understanding God. You just neutered Him. He can't do this and can't do that. He can do anything because He has unlimited and inconceivable potencies. That's Bhagavan. He possesses all potencies in full, inconceivably unlimited potencies. And thereby He can do anything, including expanding Himself fully and expanding Himself partially. Trying to cross the finish line here. So, Jiva Goswami gives three metaphors that shows this qualitative oneness. Like the sun and the sun rays. Then another is the tata. Tata is, over here is water, over here is land, and tata is where it's neither water or land. So this little fine line that goes along like this. Would you say it's water? Would you say it's land? Well, it's neither. It's tata. It's marginal. So Krishna has such a potency. He has tatasta shakti. For Him, it's not a problem. For my vadis, it's a problem. But for Him, it's not a problem. He can have spiritual potency, he can have material potency, he can have in between material and spiritual potency. That's us, living entities. We're conscious, and whether we turn our attention towards the spiritual side or the material side is going to determine our consciousness is contaminated or clear. Because we're marginal. Where do we take our shelter? The material or the spiritual energy. So the Vedas are inducing us to take shelter of the spiritual energy. Thereby, consciousness becomes purified, and then the full spiritual capacity of the living entity becomes manifested. And if we don't do that, then consciousness is contaminated, and we experience and display all kinds of other things, like Yuli's question of what's some examples of impersonalism, behavior-wise. We become attracted to the impermanent and run after it, thinking, I'm going to get some happiness over there. And then the third example is fire and heat. So fire inextricably has heat. There's a difference between each of these three metaphors, but fire has these two properties, heat and light. So, I had this experience, I won't tell you where, one temple. I felt some heat in the wall. And I knew there's heat in the wall because there's an electrical problem, and if we don't fix the electrical problem, there's going to be a fire in the wall that could burn the building just from the fire in the wall. Because there's heat. So where there's heat, there's fire. It may not be like flames yet, but there's fire. Gotta fix the problem. So as heat is inextricably connected with fire, so also the potencies of Krishna are inextricably connected with Him. There's oneness between Krishna and His potencies. Although it may not be the fullness of Krishna. Like the heat in the wall. It's not the fullness of fire. But when there's heat, there's fire. Yes? So now the application of this, the Achintya Beda Beda philosophy. Some places in the Upanishads, it emphasizes the oneness. And some places, it emphasizes the difference. That's a contradiction. How to resolve the contradiction? By understanding there's potencies of the Supreme that are unlimited. Some of the potencies are one with Him, like the living entity, is one with Him in the sense that they're conscious and different because of their size. This next slide is our last slide for the whole section. Okay. The Supreme Lord's infallible internal energy is intimately related with His essential being, like the heat of fire. And this superior potency, internal potency, controls everything else. You can say they are expansions of her. Maybe partial, maybe reflection, maybe because that's what Maya is. It's a reflection of the internal potency. Because they exist without giving up their natures. Prakriti exists. Time exists. Karma exists. But they can't touch Krishna. Why? Well, He is situated within them in the sense that they are His potencies, but He's apart from them at the same time. Right? Chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita? Yes? Chapter 9, Bhagavad Gita? I'm within everything and I'm outside of everything. Behold my mystic opulence. So Krishna is within His potencies and He's outside of His potencies at the same time. This is a Chinchabeda Veda, right in Bhagavad Gita. Rather, out of fear of Him, they maintain their particular natures. And that's a phrase that's found within the Upanishads and the Shruti mantras again and again. Though the jivas have a nature similar to the Lord, they cannot achieve the same status as the Lord. Taking shelter of Him, the jivas attain their true function. And finally, the Lord in relation to the jivas is like the chief prana in relation to the senses. Now, this is a sound vibration that He's going to elaborate coming up. It's just like a hint. A little sound vibration that's going to be expanded on further. Prana means life air. And there's different kinds of prana. And there's a principal prana. Chief prana is said here. And the chief prana, we're going to hear, I guess this evening, is when the living entity leaves the body, the prana goes with the living entity. The subtle body, but also prana goes with the living entity. So it's not just like, you know, the air around us. That's not the same as prana. It's the life air. I don't understand this science so well. But prana goes with the living entity. As the living entity doesn't change, prana doesn't change. We're going to hear some more about it. Don't ask me questions about it now, please. And prana gives life to the sense organs, the indriyas. Of course, then there's demigods that help control all of that. So, you know, it's very intricate. If you're going to make a machine that's creation, you got to get into intricate. If it's too much for your brain, don't try to become Lord Brahma. It's too complicated. Statements of non-difference, saying that the jiva is a form of the Lord, though he is dependent on the Lord and functions only in relation to the Lord, are not contradictory to statements of difference. That means there's a oneness and a difference simultaneously. Okay. It's a little complex. But there's, the essence is, there's this, Vedanta says, there's a source of everything. And Vedanta is searching for that source of everything. Janma dyasya yataha. The absolute truth is that from which everything comes. And what is that? Krishna. So there's a relationship between everything and its source of emanation, Krishna. And within those things that emanate from him, Krishna is present as his energies are present within him. And then he exhibits them or he can withdraw them at his will. So there's an intimate inseparability of all things with him, and at the same time, they're not him. So there's a difference between the source and what's emanate from the source. That's Vedanta. And Srimad Bhagavatam is the commentary on Vedanta. And the Sandarbhas is the commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam. And the teachings of Lord Chaitanya are the same as that. That's where we're going to end up with text 49 when we get there. All right. Anybody would like to raise a question? Everyone's perfectly unperplexed, right? Yes. Raghunandan.
It looks like Shankaracharya's teachings are basically even taking the living being even away from the Brahman realization towards...
They're taking things away from?
Brahman realization. Brahman realization.
Yes. It's not Brahman realization. It's philosophized Brahman.
And basically it's talking the same whitism like the
Buddha. Exactly, you got it. Although he doesn't say it, that's what he's doing. And that's what helped him become so popular. Let's go through it again. How, you know, Buddha was very powerful. He's the incarnation. So powerful that the whole of the subcontinent of India became influenced by Buddha's teachings. That's so deeply rooted in the Vedas. He just said, get rid of the Vedas, and they got rid of the Vedas. So powerful. Shankar didn't like that. Except the Vedas. And we hear it over and over. He drove the Buddhists out. Now some remained, but largely they went elsewhere. One of the popular places was to Southeast Asia. China and all the other places in Southeast Asia. They drove Shankara. He lived for 32 years. Look at the count the numbers on his, you know, when he was born and left this world. 32 years and he drove the Buddhists out of India. And restored the Vedas. To get that restoration of the Vedas, his teachings were a replica of Buddhism. Instead of saying void or nirvana, he said Brahman. But it's a philosophized Brahman only. It's actually nothingness. No this, no that, no qualities, no form, nothing. But pure knowledge. So hold up there. Knowledge. Knowledge is nothingness. Knowledge of nothingness. Buddhism. And then, you know, all the other things without the details. It's Buddhism. Under a different name. Mayavad. Exactly what Padma Purana says. It's covered Buddhism. It's Buddhism. Just in a different package. People bought into it. They liked Buddhism. And they liked the Vedas. Look out, here comes Lord Shiva. People bought into it. 32 years. Yes, you're right.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Okay. Advaita Chandra, raise your hand.
Making this very accessible, very complicated subject.
I'm trying to make it accessible. It is a complicated subject.
I have a couple of questions. The first one is, in one of the slides, you have Jiva Goswami's point about he is interpreting the Upanishads to fit with Vyasadeva's meditational experience.
Yes. When necessary. If it's, right. In many cases, direct is just fine. In some cases, it's not just fine, and then what do you do?
Right. So my understanding was the scriptures take precedence and the Acharya's realization should fit with the scriptures. But in this case, he's making an exception because Vyasadeva is the author of the Vedas. Is that why he's doing it?
No. I'll restate what you just said.
Okay.
A Sanskrit rule is the direct meaning. It's a Sanskrit rule. The direct meaning must be taken unless it doesn't fit. And if it doesn't fit, then an indirect meaning must be taken. It's a rule. So, it's not just the Acharya's rendering. They can go interpret anything they like. No, they must follow the rule. If the direct, therefore, Bhagavad Gita as it is. Not this means that. But as it is. Surrender to Krishna means surrender to Krishna. Not the unborn within Krishna. Direct meaning, surrender to Krishna. If there's some, however, it's a Sanskrit rule, if there's something that doesn't fit, or in this case, conform with the real, then some indirect or secondary meaning must be taken, because it has to conform with the us. And that's the responsibility of an Acharya, not, you know, Vishnudas, or so-and-so Prabhu. It's the responsibility of the Acharya to conform, and it's according to Sanskrit rule. The direct meaning must be taken unless. Now, does that restate better what you wanted to
point? But I'm wondering, is Vyasadeva being given higher position than the Vedas themselves?
No.
Because he's interpreting...
He's just the compiler. And within the Vedas, which he is the compiler of, there's some meanings, some statements that are indirect. Now, who is going to decide that? Vyas, within his realization. Now, who is the responsible who said, in some cases, indirect things? Well, the faithful follower of Vyas is Shukadeva. And then the faithful follower of Shukadeva is Sutta. And so forth. Then, you know, there's this process of disciplic succession. So how does Jiva Goswami come up with what he comes up with? It's by hearing from Rupa Goswami, who heard from Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So that's the method. You know, when is it okay? In disciplic succession. And if one isn't in disciplic succession, you're bound to get it wrong. Knowledge will be lost, as Krishna says. Yoga nashta parantapa. Does that help?
Yes. Can I ask one more question?
Yeah.
Does Jiva Goswami in Tattva Sandarbha address the fall down of the Jiva question?
No.
He doesn't, okay.
Yeah. Only one now.
Could you comment on Jainism, especially when Jains are very sattvic people?
Can I comment on, say it slower?
Jainism, and how does it relate
Jainism.
To, and how does it relate to our discussion?
How does it relate to this discussion?
Yes, I mean...
It's without reference to Vyas, put it that way. It's without reference to Vyas. You know, someone saw something, got a realization, and made a religion up to that, based upon that realization. Doesn't match... what Vyas says. Well, you know, you're always best to ask one question. there are, you know, as with everything, as with Shankara's teachings, there are different varieties. For example, Rishabhdev. It says in the Bhagavatam, the teachings of Rishabhdev form the basis of Jainism. You've read that? Says that in the Bhagavatam purports. But what's that Jainism? Is it the same Jainism that you go to a Jain temple today and you'll find and hear? there's an essence of, as you know, those key verses of Rishabhdev to his 100 sons, you know, a very strong message of detachment from the temporary and attachment to different shapes, and it gets twisted over time without disciplic succession. So I'm speaking about the Jainism of today, not the teachings of Rishabhdev that come from the Bhagavatam. And now, you know, this a disclaimer. I'm not a historian scholar of Jainism, so I can't say much more than that, so don't ask more than that, because I'm not a scholar of Jainism. Something else? Yes. Krishna Priya.
Why the example of the clay pot?
One example of the?
The clay pot.
The clay pots.
The open clay pot where you see the sky inside and outside. That example is usually given to prove impersonalism. So I was wondering, it is impossible to explain Achintya Beta Beta Tattva if you say that the jiva is an analogy of the clay pot. So I was curious why that was endorsed by Jiva Goswami.
The best I can do is to repeat what Jiva Goswami says. What he's saying, this is my understanding. He's saying to take Brahman is not appropriate. That is to say, yes, within a pot, there's a portion of sky, and outside of the pot, there's the rest of the sky, and when the pot is broken, that which was within the sky is indistinguishable from the pot, the sky that was outside the pot. Now, Mayavadis will take that and say, actually, all there is Brahman, just like all there is the distinguishing the sky within the pot and outside the pot is artificial. It's actually just sky. That's the Mayavadi. My understanding of what Jiva Goswami says, what is appropriate is, as within a pot there's a small amount of sky and outside is the rest of the sky, so similarly, proper understanding is, the living entity, the tiny jiva soul, is a partial of the sky that's within the pot compared to the sky that's outside the pot. It's not saying the sky has become limited or Brahman has become limited. Brahman hasn't become limited. There's tiny living entities that are eternal, not created, not ever becomes God or Brahman. It's just jiva, paraprakriti. And that paraprakriti is like the quantity of sky that's in a pot compared to the sky that's outside the pot. Not delimiting Brahman. It's already eternally tiny. Jiva Bhuta Sanatana. Eternally like that. But how is that eternally like that? Small compared to the big? Small compared to the big. Doesn't become the big. In the liberated state, break the pot and becomes the sky. Which it always was anyways. That's a false or improper presentation of this Vedic example of the pot in the sky. That's my understanding.
So we shouldn't be using that analogy for explaining that.
Say it closer to the microphone.
So we shouldn't be using that analogy to explain the jiva's position, right? It's only used to explain the division.
Yes.
But not
coming attractions. When we get to text 50 through 55, we're going to hear a whole lot about this. It's Vyasti and Samasti. Oh boy, we got some more terminology. to understand the whole, you can understand the part of the whole. To understand the drop of the ocean, you can understand the ocean. To understand what the living entity is will give you an idea of the supreme living entity, like the sky that's in the pot compared to the sky outside the pot. The part to the whole. They're qualitatively one. The gold bangle, as the example was given, compared to the gold mine. The part to the whole. The air and the sky in the pot and the sky outside the pot. Is that right? Okay. Paramarupa. Over, raise your hand.
Guru Maharaj, I did not understand the context of the Vedanta Sutra reference where it was mentioned that Brahman is not like water being involved in division or reflection. So there are two questions arising out of
that. It's complicated. That's part of the reason you didn't understand it. Should I go back to that slide and go over it again?
Yeah, if you can kindly explain it again, that would be helpful. There are two main challenges that I'm having. One is that, first of all, water is not involved in division. It's only involved in reflection. And that too, in the reflection theory we talked about, it is the reflection, Brahman getting reflected in Agyan, which is producing God. And here we are talking about Brahman is not like water.
I invite you to read the commentary on this verse because it'll explain it better than I can. Gopi Pranadana's commentary, which is based on Jiva Goswami's commentary. That'll explain it much better than I can. But I'll make a little attempt. And it will be much better if you just read what it says. According to Vedanta Sutra, Brahman is not like water in being involved in division or reflection, which is exactly what Shankar is saying. Like water reflects something. So Brahman becomes reflected on avidya. It's not to be understood like that, Vedanta Sutra is saying. So that part you get. But it's the very next verse. Brahman does assume larger and smaller sizes. Jivatma, Jiva Tattva, Vishnu Tattva. This much of the analogy applies fittingly. And then I showed those images of little, reflections of the sun dancing on the surface of the water. Those are the little ones. But the sun is a big one. And a reflection. Or I can show the big one. Just one big sun reflected in the water. It can be big one or little ones. That much it works. The reflection metaphor. All right. Read the commentary. It's text 42. In this section, this quote is taken from the commentary, Sarvasambhadani. And there's, and also Baladev made a commentary as well. So those are in the back. You can read the Gopi's commentary, read it, what's in the back. See if you can piece it together. Okay. Yes? Shankadari?
Hare Krishna Maharaj. The beginning you mentioned in the first session or second session that if we understand or if we read or if we hear Tattva Sandarbha first and understand these concepts of Mayavadi and then read Srimad Bhagavatam, that would actually help a lot. Is that right understanding? Is it, did I hear right?
Well, here's what, I'll try my best to say again what, it's in the handouts, Prabhupada's statement, more or less paraphrased. When reading Srimad Bhagavatam, it's purifying. In addition, if you have carefully studied the Sandarbhas, you'll have much greater clarity on what the Bhagavatam is conveying, and that will help you appreciate and understand the message the Bhagavatam is conveying. It'll help make the mind very sharp and clear. What are the various elements and potencies in the message of the Bhagavatam as it's being narrated and as you're hearing it by that clarity of mind?
Yes, Maharaj. So I feel that now after, you know, a little bit of clarity on what's this Mayavadi and how their thinking goes, the realizations of Sukadeva Goswami and Vyasadeva, how they are to be understood in this context, it makes more sense now. If I go back and read them, I'm sure that I understand much better.
Well, I'll just emphasize one more time. Srila Prabhupada took it as his mission. He put it in his prana mantra. Nirvishesha shunyavadi paschachade satarnini. It's something that he valued very much. He wanted to convey to us. And it's then our obligation to receive that which he wanted to convey to us. This distinction between the Vaishnava view and impersonalism and voidism view. It will help us receive that which Prabhupada wants to give, Krishna Prema. Because as long as we're adhering to or contaminated by these other ideologies, and we just go la-di-da down the path of bhakti yoga, and we don't weed out those weeds from the garden, we could get bewildered instead of clarity. So it's helpful. It's something that Prabhupada wanted us to do. And I gave the example. The first year that I was living as a bhakta in a temple, Prabhupada had published Adi Lila Chapter 7. Hardcover and softcover. I mean, it was thick. And he wanted us to read it. And it's like, boy, was it brain puzzling. But he wanted us to read it. He wanted to protect us. That's what fathers do. They want to protect their dependents from this impersonalism and voidism that has all of us contaminated, not just people from a certain part of South India. It will help us come to Shuddha Bhakti and Krishna Prema. Now, supposing you don't study Tattva Sandarbha and you just chant Hare Krishna and be happy. You know, that can also work. There's potency. Every potency is there. It's sufficient. Just chant the holy name. Now, why do we do anything else? Because we need all the help we can get. We're contaminated. So we take baths because we're contaminated. We take baths and sound vibration that takes away impurities. At least, you know, a little bit. As much as we can understand. Oh, that's the impurity. Just like this nice question of what are some practical demonstrations of behaviors that are springing from impersonalism and voidism? It's very practical. And we're all contaminated by those behaviors because we're contaminated by impersonalism and voidism. So go right to the root, not just the behavior. Behind the behavior is consciousness, contaminated consciousness. So what is that pure and what is the contaminated consciousness besides the behavior? It's helpful to get rid of the toxicity in our consciousness. It's nice to hear Krishna's pastimes. It's also nice to hear what's the foundation for Krishna's pastimes. Yes, up front here.
So Shankaracharya's teachings are philosophized Brahman.
Shankaracharya's teachings are?
You said philosophized Brahman.
Philosophized
Brahman. Brahman or covered voidism.
Yes.
So what is the conception of one who's perfectly Brahman realized? Do they have?
Well, Shukadeva Goswami. There's these two primary examples. There's others, but two primary examples are the four Kumaras and Shukadeva Goswami. They were Brahman realized. They weren't philosophized Brahman or on their way. They were there. Now, your question was, what does it look like? And the positive sense, feeling a happiness of Brahman. And the negative side is having no attraction for anything that's of the temporary nature. I mean, when Shukadeva Goswami, he was in the womb for 16 years. I mean, what happens to the natural processes of birth? He stayed in the... So, because for him, it's all one. Inside the womb, outside the womb, it's all one. And there's Maya out there, and I don't want that Maya out there. But if Krishna comes and says, I'll be free from Maya, then I'll come out. So he came out. And when he came out, he's a 16-year-old boy with the physiognomy of a 16-year-old boy. And he goes walking down the road with no clothes. Because he's not interested in anything of this temporary world. And the ladies that were bathing naked, they could understand. This fellow's detached. Here comes Vyas chasing after him. Oh, he's a householder. They cover themselves. So, you know, a symptom is absolute. And, you know, not when he became a devotee, that changed. That was already there. Foundationally, fundamentally. Detached from everything else. Now, for a Vaishnav, they also have detachment from everything else except Krishna. And they want to serve Krishna according to what's appropriate for social norms, unless they're just an avaduta. Now that's also a possibility, like Rishabdev became an avaduta. But he wasn't less realized when he was King Rishabdev. He just took a different position. But that's a symptom of Brahman realized. Totally uninterested in anything material. Now there's philosophical things said about there's different qualities of that disinterest. One is one like yuck. And the other is one is indifferent. But in either case, it's different behaviors of disinterest. Not one's better than the other, vice versa. Different ways of manifesting that disinterest. But that's a symptom of Brahman realization. A happiness, and with that happiness, feeling full, and not looking for happiness anywhere else. Nothing outside. Atmarama. Read the verse. And then there's a whole chapter in Chaitanya Charitamrita describing that verse. It's one of the verses of Vyasa's, related to Vyasa's realization. 1710. It's there.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. So, I think I heard Jiva Goswami said that Brahman is undividing, unchanging. And one of the Prabhu also asked a question whether Jiva Goswami discussed something about falling down of Jiva. So now I'm thinking Brahman is made up of living entities. When the living entities are liberated from that position, will that not change Brahman?
No.
how God.
Living entity that's covered by illusion, a living entity that's not covered by illusion. They're still living entity, doesn't change Brahman. It's not merging with, it's change of consciousness. Brahman doesn't change. The living entity doesn't change. Consciousness may change, but the living entity doesn't change. Consciousness may change.
So in a way, can we say that Brahman itself is Brahman and then there are living entities in Brahman?
No. You said that in your question before and I'm saying no. Don't say it again. No. Brahman is the impersonal aspect of the Absolute Truth. Well, that's going to come up. It's one of the verses. It's quoted several times in the upcoming verses. Vedanta tat tattva vidas tattvam yajjana madvayam. Brahmeti paramatmeti. So you're putting a condition on Brahman that's not there. Brahman is the impersonal feature. Or the effulgence of the Supreme Lord. That's what it is. It's not what you said what it is. It's what it is. The effulgence of the Supreme Lord. That's what it is. Last question. Oh, two questions. Yuli and then Beck.
This is a clarification question. So there is no notion of God in impersonalism. Is that correct?
There's no notion of a...
God.
Let me just say it back, please. There's no notion of a personal feature of God. There's only the notion of sat, or existence. Existence of what? Existence of Brahman. Existence of awareness. Existence of knowledge. That's not knowledge of what or existence of what. It's just knowledge, existence, sat. That's the impersonal conception. Impersonal conception. Pretty bland, huh? But that's Brahman realization is. That's the Brahman feature. And then there's the Paramatma feature and there's the Bhagavan feature. That includes Brahman feature and Paramatma feature. Last question back here.
Hi, Krishna Guru Maharaj. Maharaj, you were talking about the snake and the rope. Rope and the snake.
Rope and snake, okay.
Yeah. So, I was just thinking, like, now, imagining things also, like, even in, in relationships or whatever. But is it also the tendency, the impersonal tendency? Imagining about in relationships.
I'm not sure what your question is.
Like,
does your good husband understand what her question is? Try it again.
And not able
imagining,
to.
Oh, so you want to know, I'm over here looking at others and imagining things about others. Behavior of impersonalism.
Impersonal tendency.
That's your question?
Yeah.
You got a question? Yuli? Did you understand the question? I'm over here looking around at the world and I imagine this and that about other people, what's going on in their lives.
And
imitation of impersonalism. That's your question. Got it? But certainly behavior of the mind. The imaginative tendency of the mind to speculate. So you can take it in a broader sense is saying is mental speculation, a manifestation of impersonalism, manifestation of illusion. When we take shelter of illusion, where's that coming from? It's like fruitive activities or trying to enjoy the temporary. We've abandoned Krishna and we're taking shelter of the body or the mind for happiness. In a broad sense, that's impersonal, nothing else. The body or the mind, as in pursuit of happiness. So it may not be a malicious, I'm looking at other people so I can find fault with other people. But if I imagine things about other people, what's that? What's behind that? Why even go there? Looking for happiness other than my relationship with Krishna. In the vehicle of the mind or the body. Fruit of activities or mental speculation. Okay, I hope you're all hungry or something. Not hungry? Had a big breakfast? Huh? Fasting. Okay, so maybe some of you are hungry. I'll compliment you. I didn't know what it was going to be like trying to present this complicated message with a mixed audience, some of whom I know, some of whom I don't know. I don't know what, you know, various levels of Krishna consciousness you're on. I was anticipating making this presentation. I was a little bit daunted about how's it going to work. But, you know, you stuck it out. And however much you're able to understand, to your credit, and those things that you haven't understood, I would suggest many of you have the book, go back and read the book, and then you'll be able to understand more after having heard it, then you go back and read the book, or rehear the recordings again. I'll make all of these PowerPoints available for, you know, everybody that registered. If you didn't register, you can register. It's the beginning of, you know, a long journey back to Krishna to help us with greater clarity and, as I said at the very first day, you know, rapt attention with mind, with rapt attention and hearing the message of the Bhagavatam. It'll help you however much you've been able to understand. And then slowly, slowly, as you progress in Krishna consciousness, then a little light will go on. Oh, now I remember that, and that's how that fits together with this message. And then, like that, little lights will go on. Even if you don't understand today. I like that image of that little shoot or a little sprout coming out of the soil. It's like dry soil and kind of cracked at the top because some moisture got in and the seed fructified. So it's like that. Our hearts are very dry. Like Gopinath Acharya said to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya, your heart is as hard as a dry oil cake. I don't know what a dry oil cake is, but our hearts must be that hard. Or steel framed in the words of the Bhagavatam. But this sound vibration acts to awaken that dormant consciousness that's within Krishna consciousness, Krishna prema, attraction for Krishna, instead of attraction for so many temporary things. Living these mixed lives of attracted to temporary things and trying to cultivate bhakti. It's slow that way. We should those things that we have, that we feel are important, cultivate doing them for Krishna. That's the bhakti principle. And as you cultivate doing them for Krishna, then the material aspect subsides and the spiritual aspect becomes more prominent. But it's not that we're supposed to give things up. We're supposed to Krishnaize what we do by sound vibration. That's our assignment. The Art of Living. I've heard there's some group called the Art of Living group. This is the Art of Living. Starting with sound vibration. And the superlative sound vibration of Srimad Bhagavatam guided by the sadhu Vaitacharya Jiva Goswami. So we'll see you again tonight, hopefully. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.